Yet the realm of the absolute was not sufficient for either you or me. I existed there in the always, and it is from where you too have come. In the absolute, there is no experience, only knowing. Knowing is a divine state. Yet the grandest joy is in being. Being is achieved only after experience. The evolution is this: knowing, experiencing, being. This is the Holy Trinity, the triune that is God. God the Father is knowing, the parent of all understandings, the begetter of all experience, for you cannot experience that which you do not know. God the Son is experiencing, the embodiment, the acting out of all that the Father knows of itself, for you cannot be that which you have not experienced. God the Holy Spirit is being, the disembodiment of all that the Son has experienced of itself, the simple, exquisite isness possible only through the memory of the knowing and experiencing. This simple being is bliss. It is God's state after knowing and experiencing itself. It is that for which God yearned in the beginning. Of course, you're well past the point where you must have it explained to you that the Father-Son descriptions of God have nothing to do with gender. I use here the picturesque speech of your most recent scriptures. Much earlier holy writings placed this metaphor in a mother-daughter context. Neither is correct. Your mind can best hold the relationship as parent-offspring, or that which gives rise to and that which is risen. Adding the third part of the Trinity produces this relationship: that which gives rise to, that which is risen, that which is. This triune reality is God's signature. It is the divine pattern. The three in one is everywhere found in the realms of the sublime. You cannot escape it in matters dealing with time and space, God and consciousness, or any of the subtle relationships. On the other hand, you will not find the triune truth in any of life's gross relationships. The triune truth is recognized in life's subtle relationships by everyone dealing with such relationships. Some of your religionists have described the triune truth as Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. Some of your psychiatrists use the terms superconscious, conscious, and subconscious. Some of your spiritualists say mind, body, and spirit. Some of your scientists see energy, matter, ether. Some of your philosophers say a thing is not true for you until it is true in thought, word, and deed. When discussing time, you speak of three times only: past, present, future. Similarly, there are three moments in your perception: before, now, and after. In terms of spatial relationships, whether considering the points in the universe or various points in your own room, you recognize here, there, and the space in between. In matters of gross relationships, you recognize no in between. That is because gross relationships are always dyads, whereas relationships of the higher realm are invariably triads. Hence, there is left-right, up-down, big-small, fast-slow, hot-cold, and the greatest dyad ever created, male and female. There are no in-betweens in these dyads. A thing is either one thing or the other, or some greater or lesser version in relationship to one of these polarities. Within the realm of gross relationships, nothing conceptualized can exist without a conceptualization of its opposite. Most of your day-to-day experience is foundationed in this reality. Within the realm of sublime relationships, nothing which exists has an opposite. All is one, and everything progresses from one to the other in a never-ending circle. Time is such a sublime realm. in which what you call past, present, and future exist interrelationally. That is, they are not opposite, but rather parts of the same whole, progressions of the same idea, cycles of the same energy, aspects of the same immutable truth. If you conclude from this that past, present, and future exist at one and the same time, you're right. Yet now is not the moment to discuss that. We can get into this in much greater detail when we explore the whole concept of time, which we'll do later. The world is the way it is because it could not be any other way and still exist in the gross realm of physicality. Earthquakes and hurricanes, floods and tornadoes, and other of what you call natural disasters are but movements of the elements from one polarity to the other. The whole birth-death cycle is part of this movement. These are the rhythms of life, and everything in gross reality is subject to them, because life itself is a rhythm. It is a wave, a vibration, a pulsation at the very heart of the all that is. Illness and disease are opposites of health and wellness, and are made manifest in your reality at your behest. You cannot be ill without at some level causing yourself to be. And you can be well again in a moment by simply deciding to be. Deep personal disappointments are responses which are chosen, and worldwide calamities are the result of worldwide consciousness. Your question infers that I choose these events, that it is my will and desire they should occur. Yet I do not will these things into being. I merely observe you doing so. And I do nothing to stop them, because to do so would be to thwart your will. That in turn would deprive you of the God experience, which is the experience you and I have chosen together. Do not condemn, therefore, all that you would call bad in the world. Rather, ask yourself, what about this have you judged bad, and what, if anything, you wish to do to change it? Inquire within rather than without, asking, what part of myself do I wish to experience now in the face of this calamity? What aspect of being do I choose to call forth? For all of life exists as a tool of your own creation, and all of its events merely present themselves as opportunities for you to decide and be who you are. This is true for every soul, and so you see there are no victims in the universe, only creators. The masters who have walked this planet all knew this. That is why, no matter which master you might name, none imagined themselves to be victimized, though many were truly crucified. Each soul is a master, though some do not remember their origins or their heritages. Yet each creates the situation and the circumstance for its own highest purpose and its own quickest remembering in each moment called now. Judge not then the karmic path walked by another. Envy not success, nor pity failure, for you know not what is success or failure in the soul's reckoning. Call not a thing calamity, nor joyous event, until you decide or witness how it is used. For is a death a calamity if it saves the lives of thousands? And is a life a joyous event if it has caused nothing but grief? Yet even this you should not judge, but keep always your own counsel and allow others theirs. This does not mean ignore a call for help, nor the urging of your own soul to work toward the change of some circumstance or condition. It does mean avoiding labels and judgment while you do whatever you do. For each circumstance is a gift, and in each experience is hidden a treasure. There was once a soul who knew itself to be the light. This was a new soul, and so anxious for experience. I am the light, it said. I am the light. Yet all the knowing of it and all the saying of it could not substitute for the experience of it. And in the realm from which this soul emerged, there was nothing but the light. Every soul was grand, every soul was magnificent, and every soul shone with the brilliance of my awesome light. And so the little soul in question was as a candle in the sun. In the midst of the grandest light of which it was part, it could not see itself, nor experience itself as who and what it really is. Now it came to pass that this soul yearned and yearned to know itself. And so great was its yearning that I one day said, "Do you know, little one, what you must do to satisfy this yearning of yours?" "Oh, what, God, what? I'll do anything," the little soul said. "You must separate yourself from the rest of us," I answered, "and then you must call upon yourself the darkness." "What is the darkness, O Holy One?" the little soul asked. "That which you are not," I replied, and the soul understood. And so this the soul did, removing itself from the all, yea, going even unto another realm. And in this realm, the soul had the power to call into its experience all sorts of darkness, and this it did. Yet in the midst of all the darkness did it cry out, "Father, Father, why hast thou forsaken me?" "Even as have you in your blackest times. Yet I have never forsaken you, but stand by you always, ready to remind you of who you really are, ready, always ready, to call you home. Therefore, be a light unto the darkness, and curse it not. And forget not who you are in the moment of your encirclement by that which you are not. But do you praise to the creation, even as you seek to change it. And know that what you do in the time of your greatest trial can be your greatest triumph. For the experience you create is a statement of who you are and who you want to be. I've told you this story, the parable of the little soul and the sun, so that you might better understand why the world is the way it is, and how it can change in an instant, the moment everyone remembers the divine truth of their highest reality. Now, there are those who say that life is a school, and that these things which you observe and experience in your life are for your learning. I've addressed this before, and I tell you again, you came into this life with nothing to learn. You have only to demonstrate what you already know. In the demonstration of it, will you function it out and create yourself anew through your experience. Thus do you justify life and give it purpose. Thus do you render it holy.
Are you saying that all the bad things that happen to us are things of our own choosing? Do you mean that even the world's calamities and disasters are at some level created by us so that we can, what, experience the opposite of who we are? And if so, isn't there some less painful way, less painful to ourselves and others, to create opportunities for us to experience ourselves?
You've asked several questions, and they're all good ones. Let's take them one at a time. No, not all the things which you call bad,
which happened to you, are of your own choosing. Not in the conscious sense which you mean. They are all of your own creation. You are always in the process of creating, every moment, every minute, every day. How you can create, we'll go into later. For now, just take my word for it. You are a big creation machine, and you are turning on a new manifestation literally as fast as you can think. Events, occurrences, happenings, conditions, circumstance, all are created out of consciousness. Individual consciousness is powerful enough. You can imagine what kind of creative energy is unleashed whenever two two or more are gathered in my name. And mass consciousness? Why, that is so powerful it can create events and circumstances of worldwide import and planetary consequences. It would not be accurate to say, not in the way you mean it, that you are choosing these consequences. You are not choosing them any more than I am choosing them. Like me, you are observing them and deciding who you are with regard to them. Yet there are no victims in the world and no villains, and neither are you a victim of the choices of others. At some level, you have all created that which you say you detest, and having created it, you have chosen it. This is an advanced level of thinking, and it is one which all masters reach sooner or later. For it is only when they can accept responsibility for all of it that they can achieve the power to change part of it. So long as you entertain the notion that there is something or someone else out there doing it to you, you disempower yourself to do anything about it. Only when you say, "I did this," can you find the power to change it. It is much easier to change what you are doing than to change what another is doing. The first step in changing anything is to know and accept that you have chosen it to be what it is. If you can't accept this on a personal level, agree to it through your understanding that we are all one. Seek then to create change, not because the thing is wrong, but because it no longer makes an accurate statement of who you are. There's only one reason to do anything, as a statement to the universe of who you are. Used in this way, life becomes self-creative. You use life to create yourself as who you are and who you've always wanted to be. There's also only one reason to undo anything, because it is no longer a statement of who you want to be. It does not reflect you. It does not represent you. That is, it does not represent you. If you wish to be accurately represented, you must work to change anything in your life which does not fit into the picture of you that you wish to project into eternity. In the largest sense, all the bad things that happen are of your choosing. The mistake is not in choosing them, but in calling them bad. For in calling them bad, you call yourself bad, since you created them. This label you cannot accept, so rather than label yourself bad, you disown your own creations. It is this intellectual and spiritual dishonesty which lets you accept a world in which conditions are as they are. If you had to accept or even felt a deep inner sense of personal responsibility for the world, it would be a far different place. This would certainly be true if everyone felt responsible. That this is so patently obvious is what makes it so utterly painful and so poignantly ironic. The world's natural calamities and disasters, its tornadoes and hurricanes, volcanoes and floods, its physical turmoils, are not created by you specifically. What is created by you is the degree to which these events touch your life. Events occur in the universe which no stretch of the imagination could claim you instigated or created. These events are created by the combined consciousness of man. All of the world co-creating together produces these experiences. What each of you do individually is move through them, deciding what, if anything, they mean to you, and who and what you are in relationship to them. Thus, you create collectively and individually the life and times you are experiencing for the sole purpose of evolving. You've asked if there's a less painful way to undergo this process, and the answer is yes. Yet nothing in your outward experience will have changed. The way to reduce the pain which you associate with earthly experiences and events, both yours and those of others, is to change the way you behold them. You cannot change the outer event, for that has been created by the lot of you. And you are not grown enough in your consciousness to alter individually that which has been created collectively. So you must change the inner experience. This is the road to mastery in living. Nothing is painful in and of itself. Pain is the result of wrong thought. It is an error in thinking. A master can disappear the most grievous pain. In this way, the master heals. Pain results from a judgment you have made about a thing. Remove the judgment, and the pain disappears. Judgment is often based upon previous experience. Your idea about a thing derives from a prior idea about that thing. Your prior idea results from a still prior idea, and that idea from another, and so forth, like building blocks, until you get all the way back in the hall of mirrors to what I call first thought. All thought is creative, and no thought is more powerful than original thought. That is why this is sometimes also called original sin. Original sin is when your first thought about a thing is in error. That error is then compounded many times over each time you have a second or third thought about a thing. It is the job of the Holy Spirit to inspire you to new understandings that can free you from your mistakes.
Are you saying that I shouldn't feel badly about the starving children of Africa? The violence and injustice in America? The earthquake that kills hundreds in Brazil?
There are no shoulds or shouldn'ts in God's world. Do what you want to do. Do what reflects you, what represents you as a grander version of yourself. If you want to feel bad, feel bad. But judge not, and neither condemn. For you know not why a thing occurs, nor to what end. And remember you this, that which you condemn will condemn you, and that which you judge, you will one day become. Rather, seek to change those things, or support others who are changing those things, which no longer reflect your highest sense of who you are. Yet, bless all, for all is the creation of God, through life living, and that is the highest creation.
Could we just stop here for a minute and let me catch my breath? Did I hear you say there are no shoulds or shouldn'ts in God's world?
That is correct.
How can that be? If there are none in your world, where would they be?
Indeed, where?
I repeat the question. Where else would shoulds and shouldn'ts appear if not in your world?
In your imagination.
But those who have taught me all about the rights and wrongs, the do's and don'ts, the shoulds and shouldn'ts, told me all those rules were laid down by you, by God.
And those who taught you were wrong. I have never set down a right or wrong, a do or a don't. To do so would be to strip you completely of your greatest gift, the opportunity to do as you please and experience the results of that, the chance to create yourself anew in the image and likeness of who you really are. The space to produce a reality of a higher and higher you based on your grandest idea of what it is of which you are capable. To say that something, a thought, a word, an action is wrong would be as much as to tell you not to do it. To tell you not to do it would be to prohibit you. To prohibit you would be to restrict you. To restrict you would be to deny the reality of who you really are, as well as the opportunity for you to create and experience that truth. There are those who say that I have given you free will, yet these same people claim that if you do not obey me, I will send you to hell. What kind of free will is that? Does this not make a mockery of God? To say nothing of any sort of true relationship between us?
Well, now we're getting into another area I wanted to discuss, and that's this whole business about heaven and hell. From what I'm gathering here, there's no such thing as hell.
There is hell. But it is not what you think, and you do not experience it for the reasons you have been given.
What is hell?
It is the experience of the worst possible outcome of your choices, decisions, and creations. It is the natural consequence of any thought which denies me or says no to who you are in relationship to me. It is the pain you suffer through wrong thinking, Yet even the term wrong thinking is a misnomer, because there's no such thing as that which is wrong. Hell is the opposite of joy. It is unfulfillment. It is knowing who and what you are and failing to experience that. It is being less. That is hell. And there is none greater for your soul. But hell does not exist as this place you have fantasized, where you burn in some everlasting fire, exist in some state of everlasting torment. What purpose could I have in that? Even if I did hold the extraordinarily ungodly thought that you did not deserve heaven, why would I have a need to seek some kind of revenge or punishment for your failing? Wouldn't it be a simple matter for me to just dispose of you? What vengeful part of me would require that I subject you to eternal suffering of a type and at a level beyond description? If you answer, the need for justice, would not a simple denial of communion with me in heaven serve the ends of justice? Is the unending infliction of pain also required? I tell you, there is no such experience after death as you have constructed in your fear-based theologies. Yet there is an experience of the soul so unhappy, so incomplete, so less than whole, so separated from God's greatest joy, that to your soul this would be hell. But I tell you, I do not send you there, nor do I cause this experience to be visited upon you. You yourself create the experience, whenever and however you separate yourself from your own highest thought about you. You yourself create the experience, whenever you deny yourself, whenever you reject who and what you really are. Yet even this experience is never eternal. It cannot be, for it is not my plan that you shall be separated from me forever and ever. Indeed, such a thing is an impossibility. For to achieve such an event, not only would you have to deny who you are, I would have to as well. This I will never do. And so long as one of us holds the truth about you, the truth about you shall ultimately prevail.
But if there is no hell, does that mean that I can do what I want, act as I wish, commit any act without fear of retribution?
Is it fear that you need in order to be, do, and have what is intrinsically right? Must you be threatened in order to be good? What is being good? Who gets to have the final say about that? Who sets the guidelines? Who makes the rules? I tell you this, you are your own rule maker. You set the guidelines. And you decide how well you have done, how well you are doing. For you are the one who has decided who and what you really are, and who you want to be. And you are the only one who can assess how well you're doing. No one else will judge you ever, for why and how could God judge God's own creation and call it bad? If I wanted you to be and do everything perfectly, I would have left you in the state of total perfection whence you came. The whole point of the process was for you to discover yourself. Create yourself as you truly are, and as you truly wish to be. Yet you could not be that unless you also had a choice to be something else. Should I therefore punish you for making a choice that I myself have laid before you? If I did not want you to make the second choice, why would I create other than the first? This is a question you must ask yourself before you would assign me the role of a condemning God. The direct answer to your question is yes, you may do as you wish without fear of retribution. It may serve you, however, to be aware of consequences. Consequences are results, natural outcomes. These are not at all the same as retributions or punishments. Outcomes are simply that. They are what results from the natural application of natural laws. They are that which occurs quite predictably as a consequence of what has occurred. All physical life functions in accordance with natural laws. Once you remember these laws and apply them, you have mastered life at the physical level. What seems like punishment to you, or what you would call evil or bad luck, is nothing more than a natural law asserting itself.
Then if I were to know these laws and obey them, I would never have a moment's trouble again. Is that what you're telling me?
You would never experience yourself as being in what you call trouble. You would not understand any life situation to be a problem. You would not encounter any circumstance with trepidation. You would put an end to all worry, doubt, and fear. You would live as you fantasize Adam and Eve lived, not as disembodied spirits in the realm of the absolute, but as embodied spirits in the realm of the relative. Yet you would have all the freedom, all the joy, all the peace, and all the wisdom, understanding, and power of the spirit you are. You would be a fully realized being. This is the goal of your soul. This is its purpose, to fully realize itself while in the body, to become the embodiment of all that it really is. This is my plan for you. This is my ideal, that I should become realized through you. That thus, concept is turned into experience, that I might know myself experientially. The laws of the universe are laws that I laid down. They are perfect laws, creating perfect function of the physical. Have you ever seen anything more perfect than a snowflake? Its intricacy, its design, its symmetry, its conformity to itself and originality from all else, all are a mystery. You wonder at the miracle of this awesome display of nature. Yet if I can do this with a single snowflake, what think you I can do, have done, with the universe? Were you to see the symmetry of it, the perfection of its design, from the largest body to the smallest particle, you would not be able to hold the truth of it in your reality. Even now, as you get glimpses of it, you cannot yet imagine or understand its implications. Yet you can know there are implications, far more complex and far more extraordinary than your present comprehension can embrace. Shakespeare said it wonderfully. There are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than are dreamt of in your philosophy.
Then how can I know these laws? How can I learn them?
It is not a question of learning, but of remembering.
How can I remember them?
Begin by being still. Quiet the outer world, so that the inner world might bring you sight. This insight is what you seek, yet you cannot have it while you are so deeply concerned with your outer reality. Seek, therefore, to go within as much as possible. And when you are not going within, come from within as you deal with the outside world. Remember this axiom: if you do not go within, you go without. Put it in the first person as you repeat it to make it more personal. If I do not go within, I go without. You have been going without all your life, yet you do not have to and never did. There is nothing you cannot be, there is nothing you cannot do, there is nothing you cannot have.
Well, that sounds like a pie-in-the-sky promise.
What other kind of promise would you have God make? Would you believe me if I promised you less? For thousands of years, people have disbelieved the promises of God for the most extraordinary reason. They were too good to be true. So you have chosen a lesser promise, a lesser love. For the highest promise of God proceeds from the highest love. Yet you cannot conceive of a perfect love, and so a perfect promise is also inconceivable, as is a perfect person. Therefore, you cannot believe even in yourself. Failing to believe in any of this means failure to believe in God. For belief in God produces belief in God's greatest gift, unconditional love, and God's greatest promise, unlimited potential.
May I interrupt you here? I hate to interrupt God when he's on a roll, but I've heard this talk of unlimited potential before, and it doesn't square with the human experience. Forget the difficulties encountered by the average person. What about the challenges of those born with mental or physical limitations? Is their potential unlimited?
You have written so in your own scripture, in many ways and in many places.
Give me one reference.
Look to see what you have written in Genesis chapter 11, verse 6 of your Bible.
It says, And the Lord said, Behold, the people are one, and they have all one language. And this is only the beginning of what they will do. And now nothing will be restrained from them which they have imagined to do.
Yes. Now, can you trust that?
Well, that does not answer the question of the feeble, the infirm, the handicapped, those who are limited.
You think they are limited, as you put it, not of their choice? Do you imagine that a human soul encounters life challenges, whatever they may be, by accident? Is this your imagining?
Do you mean that a soul chooses what kind of life it will experience ahead of time?
No. That would defeat the purpose of the encounter. The purpose is to create your own experience, and thus create yourself, in the glorious moment of now. You do not therefore choose the life you will experience ahead of time. You may, however, select the persons, places, and events, the conditions and circumstances, the challenges and obstacles, the opportunities and options with which to create your experience. You may select the colors for your palette, the tools for your chest, the machinery for your shop. What you create with these is your business. That is the business of life. Your potential is unlimited in all that you've chosen to do. Do not assume that a soul which has been incarnated in a body which you call limited has not reached its full potential, for you do not know what that soul was trying to do. You do not understand its agenda. You are unclear as to its intent. Therefore, bless every person and condition and give thanks. Thus you affirm the perfection of God's creation and show your faith in it. For nothing happens by accident in God's world, and there is no such thing as coincidence. Nor is the world buffeted by random choice or something you call fate. If a snowflake is utterly perfect in its design, do you not think the same could be said about something as magnificent as your life?
But even Jesus healed the sick. Why would he heal them if their condition was so perfect?
Jesus did not heal those he healed because he saw their condition as imperfect. He healed those he healed because he saw those souls asking for healing as part of their process. He saw the perfection of the process. He recognized and understood the soul's intention. But Jesus felt that all illness, mental or physical, represented imperfection. Would he not have simply healed everyone on the planet all at once? Do you doubt that he could do this?
No. No, I believe he could have.
Good. Then the mind begs to know, why did he not do it? Why would the Christ choose to have some suffer and others be healed? For that matter, why does God allow any suffering at any time? This question has been asked before, and the answer remains the same. There is perfection in the process. And all life arises out of choice. It is not appropriate to interfere with choice, nor to question it. It is particularly inappropriate to condemn it. What is appropriate is to observe it, and then to do whatever might be done to assist the soul in seeking and making a higher choice. Be watchful, therefore, of the choices of others, but not judgmental. Know that their choice is perfect for them in this moment now. Yet stand ready to assist them should the moment come when they seek a newer choice, a different choice, a higher choice. Move into communion with the souls of others and their purpose. Their intention will be clear to you. This is what Jesus did with those he healed, and with all those whose lives he touched. Jesus healed all those who came to him or who sent others to him, supplicating for them. He did not perform a random healing. To have done so would have been to violate a sacred law of the universe. Allow each soul to walk its path.
But does that mean we must not help anyone without being asked? Surely not. Or we would never be able to help the starving children of India, or the tortured masses of Africa, or the poor, or the downtrodden anywhere. All humanitarian effort would be lost, all charity forbidden. Must we wait for an individual to cry out to us in desperation, or for a nation of people to plead for help, before we're allowed to do what is obviously right?
You see, the question answers itself. If a thing is obviously right, do it. But remember to exercise extreme judgment regarding what you call right and wrong. A thing is only right or wrong because you say it is. A thing is not right or wrong intrinsically.
It isn't.
Rightness or wrongness is a subjective judgment in a personal value system. By your subjective judgments do you create yourself. By your personal values do you determine and demonstrate who you are. The world exists exactly as it is so that you may make these judgments. If the world existed in perfect condition, your life process of self-creation would be terminated. It would end. A lawyer's career would end tomorrow were there no more litigation. A doctor's career would end tomorrow were there no more illness. A philosopher's career would end tomorrow were there no more questions.
And God's career would end tomorrow were there no more problems.
Precisely. You've put it perfectly. We, all of us, would be through creating were there nothing more to create. We, all of us, have a vested interest in keeping the game going. Much as we all say we would like to solve all the problems, we dare not solve all the problems, or there will be nothing left for us to do. Your industrial-military complex understands this very well. That is why it opposes mightily any attempt to install a war-no-more government anywhere. Your medical establishment understands this, too. That is why it staunchly opposes. It has to, for its own survival. Any new miracle drug or cure, to say nothing of the possibility of miracles themselves. Your religious community also holds this clarity. That is why it attacks uniformly any definition of God, which does not include fear, judgment, and retribution, and any definition of self, which does not include their own idea of the only path to God. If I say to you, you are God, where does that leave religion? If I say to you, you are healed, where does that leave science and medicine? If I say to you, you shall live in peace, where does that leave the peacemakers? If I say to you, the world is fixed, where does that leave the world? What now of plumbers? The world is filled with essentially two kinds of people. Those who give you things you want and those who fix things. In a sense, even those who simply give you things you want, the butchers, the bakers, the candlestick makers are also fixers. For to have a desire for something is often to have a need for it. That is why addicts are said to need a fix. Be careful, therefore, that desire not become addiction.
Are you saying the world will always have problems? Are you saying that you actually want it that way?
I am saying that the world exists the way it exists, just as a snowflake exists the way it exists, quite by design. You have created it that way, just as you have created your life exactly as it is. I want what you want. The day you really want an end to hunger,
there will be no more hunger. I have given you all the resources with which to do that. You have all the tools with which to make that choice. You have not made it. Not because you cannot make it. The world could end world hunger tomorrow. You choose not to make it. You claim that there are good reasons that 40,000 people a day must die of hunger. There are no good reasons. Yet, at a time when you say you can do nothing to stop 40,000 people a day from dying of hunger, you bring 50,000 people a day into your world to begin a new life. And this you call love. This you call God's plan. It is a plan which totally lacks logic or reason, to say nothing of compassion. I am showing you in stark terms that the world exists the way it exists because you have chosen for it to. You are systematically destroying your own environment. Then pointing to so-called natural disasters as evidence of God's cruel hoax or nature's harsh ways. You have played the hoax on yourself, and it is your ways which are cruel. Nothing, nothing is more gentle than nature. And nothing, nothing has been more cruel to nature than man. Yet you step aside from all involvement in this, deny all responsibility. It is not your fault, you say. And in this you are right. It is not a question of fault. It is a matter of choice. You can choose to end the destruction of your rainforests tomorrow. You can choose to stop depleting the protective layer hovering over your planet. You can choose to discontinue the ongoing onslaught of your Earth's ingenious ecosystem. You can seek to put the snowflake back together, or at least to halt its inexorable melting. But will you do it? You can similarly end all war tomorrow. Simply, easily. All it takes, all it has ever taken, is for all of you to agree. Yet if you cannot all agree on something as basically simple as ending the killing of each other, how can you call upon the heavens with shaking fist to put your life in order? I will do nothing for you that you will not do for yourself. That is the law and the prophets. The world is in the condition it is in because of you and the choices you have made or failed to make. Not to decide is to decide. The earth is in the shape it's in because of you and the choices you have made or failed to make. Your own life is the way it is because of you and the choices you have made or failed to make.
But I did not choose to get hit by that truck. I did not choose to get mugged by that robber or raped by that maniac. People could say that. There are people in the world who could say that.
You are all at root cause for the conditions which exist, which create in the robber the desire or the perceived need to steal. You have all created the consciousness which makes rape possible. It is when you see in yourself that which caused the crime that you begin at last to heal the condition from which it sprang. Feed your hungry. Give dignity to your poor. Grant opportunity to your less fortunate. End the prejudice which keeps masses huddled and angry with little promise of a better tomorrow. Put away your pointless taboos and restrictions upon sexual energy. Rather, help others to truly understand its wonder and to channel it properly. Do these things, and you will go a long way toward ending robbery and rape forever. As for the so-called accident, the truck coming around the bend, the brick falling from the sky, learn to greet each such incident as a small part of a larger mosaic. You have come here to work out an individual plan for your own salvation. Yet salvation does not mean saving yourself from the snares of the devil. There is no such thing as the devil, and hell does not exist. You are saving yourself from the oblivion of non-realization. You cannot lose in this battle. You cannot fail. Thus, it is not a battle at all, but simply a process. Yet, if you do not know this, you will see it as a constant struggle. You may even believe in the struggle long enough to create a whole religion around it. This religion will teach that struggle is the point of it all. This is a false teaching. It is in not struggling that the process proceeds. It is in surrendering that the victory is won. Accidents happen because they do. Certain elements of the life process have come together in a particular way at a particular time with particular results. Results which you choose to call unfortunate for your own particular reasons. Yet they may not be unfortunate at all, given the agenda of your soul. I tell you this, there is no coincidence, and nothing happens by accident. Each event and adventure is called to yourself by yourself in order that you might create and experience who you really are. All true masters know this. That is why mystic masters remain unperturbed in the face of the worst experiences of life, as you would define them. The great teachers of your Christian religion understand this. They know that Jesus was not perturbed by the crucifixion, but expected it. He could have walked away, but he did not. He could have stopped the process at any point. He had that power. Yet he did not. He allowed himself to be crucified in order that he might stand as man's eternal salvation. Look, he said, at what I can do. Look at what is true. And know that these things and more shall you also do. For have I not said, ye are gods? Yet you do not believe. If you cannot, then believe in yourself. believe in me. Such was Jesus' compassion that he begged for a way and created it to so impact the world that all might come to heaven, self-realization, if in no other way than through him. For he defeated misery and death, and so might you. The grandest teaching of Christ was not that you shall have everlasting life, but that you do. Not that you shall have brotherhood in God, but that you do. Not that you shall have whatever you request, but that you do. All that is required is to know this, for you are the creator of your own reality, and life can show up no other way for you than that way in which you think it will. You think it into being. This is the first step in creation. God the Father is thought. Your thought is the parent which gives birth to all things.
This is one of the laws we are to remember.
Yes.
Can you tell me others?
I've told you others. I've told you them all since the beginning of time. Over and over I've told you them. Teacher after teacher have I sent you. You do not listen to my teachers. You kill them.
But why? Why do we kill the holiest among us? We kill them or dishonor them, which is the same thing. Why?
Because they stand against every thought you have that would deny me. And deny me you must if you are to deny yourself.
Why would I want to deny you or me?
Because you're afraid. And because my promises are too good to be true. Because you cannot accept the grandest truth. And so you must reduce yourself to a spirituality which teaches fear and dependence and intolerance rather than love and power and acceptance. You're filled with fear. And your biggest fear is that my biggest promise might be life's biggest lie. And so you create the biggest fantasy you can to defend yourself against this. You claim that any promise which gives you the power and guarantees you the love of God must be the false promise of the devil. God would never make such a promise, you tell yourself. Only the devil would, to tempt you into denying God's true identity as the fearsome, judgmental, jealous, vengeful, and punishing entity of entities. Even though this description better fits the definition of a devil, if there were one. You have assigned devilish characteristics to God in order to convince yourself not to accept the godlike promises of your creator or the godlike qualities of the self. Such is the power of fear.
I'm trying to let go of my fear. Will you tell me again more of the laws?
The first law is that you can be, do, and have whatever you can imagine. The second law is that you attract what you fear.
Why is that?
Emotion is the power which attracts. That which you fear strongly, you will experience. An animal, which you consider a lower form of life, even though animals act with more integrity and greater consistency than humans, knows immediately if you are afraid of it. Plants, which you consider an even lower form of life, respond to people who love them far better than to those who couldn't care less. None of this is by coincidence. There is no coincidence in the universe. Only a grand design, an incredible snowflake. Emotion is energy in motion. When you move energy, you create effect. If you move enough energy, you create matter. Matter is energy conglomerated, moved around, shoved together. If you manipulate energy long enough in a certain way, you get matter. Every master understands this law. It's the alchemy of the universe. It's the secret of all life. Thought is pure energy. Every thought you have ever had, and ever will have, is creative. The energy of your thought never, ever dies. Ever. It leaves your being and heads out into the universe, extending forever. A thought is forever. All thoughts congeal. All thoughts meet other thoughts, crisscrossing in an incredible maze of energy, forming an ever-changing pattern of unspeakable beauty and unbelievable complexity. Like energy attracts like energy, forming, to use simple words, clumps of energy of like kind. When enough similar clumps crisscross each other, run into each other, they stick to each other, to use another simple term. It takes an incomprehensibly huge amount of similar energy sticking together thusly to form matter. But matter will form out of pure energy. In fact, that is the only way it can form. Once energy becomes matter, it remains matter for a very long time, unless its construction is disrupted by an opposing or dissimilar form of energy. This dissimilar energy, acting upon matter, actually dismembers the matter, releasing the raw energy of which it was composed. This is, in elementary terms, the theory behind your atomic bomb. Einstein came closer than any other human being, before or since, to discovering, explaining, and functionalizing the creative secret of the universe. You should now better understand how people of like mind can work together to create a favored reality. The phrase, wherever two or more are gathered in my name, becomes much more meaningful. Of course, when entire societies think a certain way, very often astonishing things happen, not all of them necessarily desirable. For instance, a society living in fear very often, actually, inevitably, produces in form that which it fears most. Similarly, large communities or congregations often find miracle-producing power in combined thinking, or what some people call common prayer. And it must be made clear that even individuals, if their thought, prayer, hope, wish, dream, fear, is amazingly strong, can, in and of themselves, produce such results. Jesus did this regularly. He understood how to manipulate energy and matter, how to rearrange it, how to redistribute it, how to utterly control it. Many masters have known this. Many know it now. You can know it right now. This is the knowledge of good and evil of which Adam and Eve partook. Until they understood this, there could be no life as you know it. Adam and Eve, the mythical names you have given to represent first man and first woman, were the father and mother of the human experience. What has been described as the fall of Adam was actually his upliftment, the greatest single event in the history of humankind. For without it, the world of relativity would not exist. The act of Adam and Eve was not original sin, but in truth, first blessing. You should thank them from the bottom of your hearts, for in being the first to make a wrong choice, Adam and Eve produced the possibility of making any choice at all. In your mythology, you have made Eve the bad one, the temptress who ate of the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil, and coyly invited Adam to join her. This mythological setup has allowed you to make woman man's downfall ever since, resulting in all manner of warped realities, not to mention distorted sexual views and confusions. How can you feel so good about something so bad? What you most fear is what will most plague you. Fear will draw it to you like a magnet. All your holy scriptures of every religious persuasion and tradition which you have created contain the clear admonition, fear not. Do you think this is by accident? The laws are very simple. Thought is creative. Fear attracts like energy. Love is all there is.
Oops, you got me on that third one. How can love be all there is if fear attracts like energy?
Love is the ultimate reality. It is the only, the all, the feeling of love is your experience of God. In highest truth, love is all there is, all there was, and all there ever will be. When you move into the absolute, you move into love. The realm of the relative was created in order that I might experience myself. This has already been explained to you. This does not make the realm of the relative real. It is a created reality you and I have devised and continue to devise in order that we may know ourselves experientially. Yet the creation can seem very real. Its purpose is to seem so real we accept it as truly existing. In this way, God has contrived to create something else other than itself. Though in strictest terms, this is impossible, since God is I am, all that is. In creating something else, namely the realm of the relative, I have produced an environment in which you may choose to be God rather than simply being told that you are God, in which you may experience Godhead as an act of creation rather than a conceptualization, in which the little candle in the sun, the littlest soul, can know itself as the light. Fear is the other end of love. It is the primal polarity. In creating the realm of the relative, I first created the opposite of myself. Now, in the realm in which you live on the physical plane, there are only two places of being, fear and love. Thoughts rooted in fear will produce one kind of manifestation on the physical plane. Thoughts rooted in love will produce another. The masters who have walked the planet are those who have discovered the secret of the relative world and refuse to acknowledge its reality. In short, masters are those who have chosen only love. In every instance, in every moment, in every circumstance, even as they were being killed, they love their murderers. Even as they were being persecuted, they love their oppressors. This is very difficult for you to understand, much less emulate. Nevertheless, it is what every master has ever done. It doesn't matter what the philosophy, it doesn't matter what the tradition, it doesn't matter what the religion, it is what every master has done. This example and this lesson has been laid out so clearly for you, time and time again. Over and over has it been shown to you. Through all the ages and in every place, through all your lifetimes and in every moment, the universe has used every contrivance to place this truth before you, in song and story, in poetry and dance, in words and in motion, in pictures of motion.